Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, we'll learn about the results of a study of the impact of industrial farm animal production in America, its impacts on public health, the environment, animal welfare, and rural communities. We're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, large numbers of animals of the same species confined in a facility where movement is restricted. My guests today note that these feedlots generally allow more uniform feeding. They allow mechanized feeding and watering, therefore the use of fewer and less skilled farm workers, and they can result in greater uniformity of animal products. There are big cost savings for the meat producer. But my guests say that this movement from small family farm to large industrial agriculture results in unintended consequences, associated social, environmental, economic, and public health problems. Problems that they say the American public is generally unaware of these problems. We'll find out more. Study by the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. It's a project of the Pew Charitable Trusts and Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Their new report is entitled Putting Meat on the Table, Industrial Farm Animal Production in America. We welcome the executive director of the commission, Bob Martin, joins us in our studios.
Thank you for having me, Fred.
And commission member Bill Nyman is here.
Thank you. Great to be here, Fred.
And with us, Joe Logan, director of environmental programs for the Ohio Environmental Council. They're hosting the Pew Commission members here in Columbus. Joe Logan, welcome.
Good morning, Fred. Great to be on your program.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Well, we have these images of, I suppose, the family farm with the cattle grazing peacefully and the chickens scratching, et cetera. But what would we see if we visited one of these concentrated feeding operations? What does it look like?
Well, Fred, we've had the opportunity, obviously, to view the whole array of agricultural production in Ohio, from the chicken scratching in the backyard, as you'd mentioned, to the more industrialized facilities. And I think it is a worrisome issue. If we actually walked into those, first from the outside, you simply see a metal barn with some enormous fans, perhaps clad in feathers and some debris. And once you go inside, it is a maze of industrial components and poultry. These poultry are very often owned by an enterprise, owned by the processing company, all the way from their inception to their final demise. And either the poultry themselves or their eggs are produced in a very industrialized manner. And I think our organization, the Environmental Council, along with the Farmers Union and a number of other organizations, have questioned for many years whether this is a wise way to proceed the industrialization of agriculture. And so we were delighted to see the Pew Commission take on this trust, and Bob and Bill is participating in that. I think it's been very helpful to our understanding of that.
Hmm. Well, Bob, when we say industrialized production, whether it's chickens or whether it's cattle or hogs, I mean, what does that mean?
Well, it really means the method of production, the style of production. In swine, it generally means these very restrictive gestation crates where the sow can only move forwards and backwards, cannot turn around in the crate.
Can lie down? No.
Well, it can lie down with some difficulty, but not as easily as if they're in a pen system.
What's a gestation crate? I mean, what?
Well, it's the metal crate that's just marginally larger than the sow itself, that the sow is kept in from the time that she's inseminated until right at birth, and then she's moved to a farrowing crate where she is with her pigs. Mm-hmm. It's very restrictive. We visited a farm in North Carolina, and I think there were 15,000 sows in one barn. They're bred for uniformity of meat and weight gain. The consequence, or the unintended consequence of that, is they're very aggressive because they've been bred to produce a certain style of pork chop, and it's really I think factory is the best term for it when you go into one of these large facilities. We visited an egg production facility.
Let me ask you about the hog production. I mean, sure. in these small metal crates, right? And somebody might say, well, all right, that's very efficient. You use a minimal amount of space for each hog, you have the gestation crate and then the farrowing crate. It's a little larger. And what's wrong with that?
Well, these animals are as smart as your family dog. They're very intelligent animals. They're very social animals. And contrary to the public image of them, they're very clean animals. And for them to have to stand on a slatted floor and their waste falls through it and is washed away, enormous amounts of water are used in these facilities, it's really forcing an animal to be something that it is not. And I think that's, you know, limiting, restricting the movement is you know, why it's so inhumane. And it's why the commission wanted to phase out over a 10-year period all restrictive confinement like that, gestation crates, veal stalls, and battery cages.
Mm-hmm. What's a veal stall? What is that?
It's essentially analogous sort of piece of equipment that's used for young veal baby calves that are usually male calves that are held, once again, in very narrow, confined areas and fed aggressively through their very short period of life. And that's where they stay, in that short veal stall.
Mm-hmm. And they're usually tethered in some fashion, so they can't move either. And the key is to not let them move so they gain weight quickly and there's not much development of muscle.
So we're getting, and you don't want the muscle development because you want the tender meat. Is that the idea? But again, this is efficient. Certainly, that's true, Bill Nyman. I know you have you raise your own cattle, turkeys, goats. I mean, you can't argue with efficiency here, and you can't argue with the uniformity of production of the kind of meat that comes out here.
Well, I can actually argue that myself.
Can you?
I think we really is we have a moral obligation to provide an environment where an animal can thrive, enjoy life. Just because it's destined to be on our plate doesn't mean it shouldn't have a good life. And quite frankly, what I've learned through my experience and with the over 600 family-owned farms that make up the Nyman Ranch Network now is that the food tastes better when the animals are given an opportunity to realize their instinctive needs. And additionally, when you give them an environment they can thrive in, it doesn't require man-made compounds to keep them healthy and well. So to think it's more efficient, and it's more efficient from a management and a labor point of view,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and the care that's necessary to keep the animals thriving.
I mean, fewer farm workers, right? Lower skills.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But animal husbandry has to be replaced by man-made compounds, and that's the nature of the industry today. And this is one of the primary concerns from a public health point viewpoint that the Pew Commission was charged with examining and considering. And I have to say it was a privilege for me to be on that commission with some academic leaders, some industry leaders, former governor of Kansas, yeah, Dan Glickman, former secretary. So it was an incredibly fertile group that looked at these issues very carefully.
When you say, Bill, that animal husbandry has to be replaced by compounds, you said, tell me what you mean.
Antibiotics being one of those man-made compounds. So if you're going to create the kind of environment that, unfortunately, the public doesn't get to see, there's no transparency in our system, the gestation traits, the crates, the veal crates, and the egg-laying battery cages, when you're going to crowd animals into that environment where they're sharing feces and living over their feces and breathing the fumes that result in that, you're going to have to do something to keep them thriving because they can't thrive in that kind of environment. And this use of antibiotics and other antimicrobials to keep them healthy, keep their digestive systems working, mm-hmm, keep them from getting sick in those environments, which are very challenging. You can't do it. They can't do it on their own. They need some help.
Let me challenge you. Why is that bad, Bob Martin, to be giving these animals these antibiotics, as you say, in these environments? As Bill says, they may not thrive without the antibiotics, but okay, so why not?
Well, the misuse of antibiotics in animal agriculture is contributing to the phenomenon of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The Union of Concerned Scientists estimates that up to 70% of the antibiotics used in the country are used for weight gain and feed efficiency and to suppress bacterial organisms because the animals are housed in unclean and in inhumane surroundings. That antibiotic-resistant bacteria gets into the environment. Bacteria can transfer their resistance among themselves. Bacteria that have never been exposed to antibiotics can pick up resistance to antibiotics from those that have. A recent study by Johns Hopkins found that antibiotic-resistant bacteria was in the plume following chicken trucks as they're transporting chickens to slaughter in the Delmarva Peninsula. It covered the inside of the test car and the equipment in the test car. So it's a very serious public health threat. There is ongoing research from the University of Iowa that is studying the development of MRSA in swine and the impact that has on CAFO workers.
I know you used a couple of words there. I don't know, CAFO and MRSA, what does that mean?
MRSA is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or the antibiotic-resistant staph infection that is becoming too common in locker rooms. You know, the Cleveland Brown, Kellen Winslow, had a MRSA infection he'd picked up at a clinic. And CAFO's the acronym for concentrated animal feeding operation.
Concentrated animal feeding operations. But how do these do these kind of resistant bacteria, you say they are able to be transferred beyond the animal feeding operation then?
Oh, absolutely. They persist in the environment. They can be carried on particulate matter coming out of the vented out of the CAFOs with the big exhaust fans. They've been found to be up to 5 miles away from the CAFO in the downwind plume of the vent fans. Johns Hopkins has done testing on so-called natural fertilizer available at a common hardware store chain in Maryland that relies on poultry litter as its basic component, and they found antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the fertilizer. So it's a serious problem.
When you look at human populations surrounding these concentrated animal feeding operations, these feedlots or these indoor operations, do you see evidence of more disease or more illness that you could trace back?
Yes. The University of Iowa has, again, done studies on the increased rates of childhood asthma in the downwind plume from swine facilities. That's basically because of the increased particulate matter, the ammonia and hydrogen sulfide coming out of these facilities when they're vented. There are reports, documented medical reports of asthma around chicken facilities, egg facilities as well.
Greater incidence.
Greater incidence. Greater instance of depression.
How would now you're talking about depression as a mental illness?
Yes.
Why would that be? How would that connect with?
Well, I don't know the medical reason, but I'm guessing that protracted exposure to ammonia and hydrogen sulfide can alter the brain in a way that that leads to that.
That's the theory. Personnel proposed this theory that there is a connection between the
two? Well, I think that is still under study, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of data supporting that theory, in both in North Carolina and in Iowa, which were the two primary hog confinement states. And there's been a lot of work done on actual workers who are really exposed daily. And as a commission, we found this stuff so conclusive and so alarming that as we looked ahead 30 years, that we felt that the public need to be made aware of this. Mm-hmm. At least our report serves as a kind of an encyclopedia of the data, and it's a great reference to all these studies, which are legion.
Bill, you say conclusive data in terms of effect on the workers in these operations. For example, what did you find?
Well, the rate of respiratory problems was dramatic, especially even within the family members of the employees who lived within close proximity, the incidence of not only childhood but adult asthma, but also adult respiratory problems, and this whole thing about malaise and depression, which has been very well documented, it seems like a giant leap from airborne pathogens coming mm-hmm. from confinement operations, but. Yeah, the studies have been done, and they're recent, and it's I hate to use the term good science, but I think it's represented here. And
but it shows a connection between these airborne effluents, whatever they are, and malaise and depression. But nobody understands how that mechanism works, I would imagine, do they?
Not necessarily about on the psychological effects, but what they do understand the pathology or the science of how the airborne pathogens are creating problems in the antibiotic resistance. They measure the air going into the barn. They test there's airborne bacteria everywhere, so they test how the airborne bacteria prior to entering the barn, how they react to the antibiotics that are commonly used in humans, and the antibiotics are effective against them. But the air that comes out of the other end of the barn, which comes out constantly because they change the air every few minutes in a barn, the bacteria that are airborne there are resistant to the bacteria. So that's a pretty alarming fact.
So when I've been up in northern Ohio, northeastern Ohio, and I've passed a farm that has a large chicken operation, and these big fans. I mean, the odor was kind of incredible. I'm driving by in the car with the windows down, and this incredible odor is pushed out by these fans. But you're saying that's not just an offensive odor, that there's over time a health risk there for people.
Well, there is no question. Hydrogen sulfide, which is one of the compounds that's known to be emitted from poultry and hog facilities especially, is a known neurotoxin. So we know that it can have influence on brain activity, and so that there's an obvious ability to make a linkage there. We don't know with any certainty what the mechanism is. And ammonia is also probably what you've smelled most pungently as you've driven by. And we don't know exactly how that influences the brain, but we know it's a very powerful chemical.
We're talking with members of the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. They have a new report called Putting Meat on the Table, Industrial Farm Animal Production in America, looking at some of the perhaps unintended consequences of large industrial agriculture operations, concentrated agriculture, feeding operations, big feeding lots, outdoors and indoors. Bob Martin is the executive director of the Pew Commission. We have commission member Bill Nyman, who's also a rancher here raising cattle, turkeys, goats. So with us also Joe Logan, director of environmental programs for the Ohio Environmental Council. They're hosting the Pew Commission members here in Columbus. We're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join us with a question or comment. You can email comments to openline@wosu.org. Bill Nyman, you said something earlier that intrigued me. I wanted to get back to you. You talked about quality of life for the animals, and you say we have a moral obligation to provide them with a decent quality of life until we slaughter them, right? I wonder where you would believe that moral obligation arises. Where does it come from?
Well, I mean, it's biblical. It's human. We're asking these animals for the ultimate sacrifice. I mean, we're raising them and we for food, and I think there's an obligation to treat something with respect and dignity that you're going to benefit so greatly from, and that's it's so natural to me to have that way of thinking. Fred, if you don't mind, I'd like to back up to one point. How do we know that the danger in these environments? Well, This is this point about our moral obligation too. The animals that are living in these buildings over their manure, if the power goes out, these animals are dead within 1 minute. If the power goes out, the workers who are in those barns, if they can't get out quickly enough, they're dead in 1 minute.
Because how does that work?
Because of the hydrogen sulfide and the ammonia.
And the fans can't evacuate it.
Exactly. So they're living over a toxic – they're living in a toxic environment, and the workers are working in a toxic environment. And the way those animals and workers can survive is by exhausting the air from those buildings. So what more does one have to know to assume that there's a risk inherent in that process?
Does the power sometimes go out?
Does the power sometimes go out?
Absolutely.
I mean, sure, they have backup generators, but if the backup generator doesn't happen to kick on or somebody hasn't maintained that properly, then there's trouble in paradise.
So do the workers flee the building at that point? Do they understand they've got to get out?
Oh, of course. They know that.
Yeah.
And we have mostly an immigrant population operating these, and they may not have the reading skills, or they may not have been able to benefit from a training process or procedure, OSHA-mandated kind of process to warn these folks of what can happen if the power goes out. And not only that, farmers who are well aware of the risk and danger, they themselves are often caught in cleaning out manure pits or power out, and they don't – and they've – died. And
there have been some fatalities here. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. Good Samaritans driving down the road trying to flag down to help these people have gone into these manure pits to help people get out, and they've died. And these are not rare occurrences. They actually happen. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be, there's a message there.
Yeah, beyond the overtly humane aspect of this, there's always the issue that we think it's responsible for people to kind of understand the conditions under which their food is produced so that they can make responsible choices. And those may eventually move the ball or move the needle in terms of the way animals are produced in this country.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about effects on human health. We've talked about animal welfare and lethal effects, Bill, in some cases. What about environmental effects? What do you find in terms of the environment? You've got in big feeding operations, I imagine, you've got a fair amount of waste to be disposed of. And how has it gone about, and is there any problem?
Yes, we found a very serious problem. One of our recommendations was to phase out the liquid management, manure management systems that are fairly common in a lot of large dairies and swine operations. The manure's flushed from under the barn. The swine barn into an open pit, and it's held for a short amount of time and then sprayed on a surrounding field as the process of disposal without any treatment other than sitting in an open pit for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with a lot of large dairies. With egg production and broiler production, we found in visiting a big facility in northwest Arkansas that they actually don't clean the barns very, very thoroughly or very frequently. They move hens in and out in about a 48-day cycle, and usually it was every fifth cycle that they would take time out to clean out the barn. So you have and there might be 100,000 hens in one barn, so you've had maybe a 500,000 hens leaving waste and feed remnants in a barn that's kept at 90 degrees while they're in there, for about a 200-day period, and so then it's scooped out and composted and deposited on the land. One of the problems is, I think the real central problem, whether it's animal welfare or environment or human health, is concentrating so many animals in one area.
Mm-hmm.
You eliminate the land's ability to absorb the nutrients. There are rivers all over the country that are polluted with excess phosphorus and nitrates. There's a plume several states large in the Gulf of Mexico now. It's the largest it's ever been from runoff from crop agriculture that's used to support these large operations and animal waste that's killing parts of the Gulf of Mexico. We learned from Joe when we came that there's a new dead zone in Lake Erie that's attributed to agricultural runoff. And so it's a very serious environmental problem.
Mm-hmm. When we say agricultural, dead zone in Lake Erie, that's mostly chemicals for feed crops. Is that right? For soybeans and corn what?
Corn and soybeans are the two primary crops grown in, especially what we're talking about is the Maumee River area in western northwestern Ohio. And as it feeds into the western basin of Lake Erie, obviously corn and soybeans are two primary crops in terms of acreage. Those are used almost exclusively in support of livestock agriculture. 60-80% of the corn goes to livestock and at least that higher percentage of the soybeans.
It's mm-hmm. also the nitrates and phosphates that are coming from the manure the operations in the watershed of that river as well as the whole Ohio and Mississippi Valley. So that goes
directly
to the Gulf of Mexico.
The watershed, yeah.
Sure.
Let's talk more about those environmental effects and callers. We will get to you right after these messages as we come back with our panel at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day. 15 years ago, the Wu-Tang Clan burst onto New York's rap scene with its album, Enter the 36 Chambers.
I thought it was incredible.
Our metaphors was new. Our slang was original. Like, you couldn't hear it nowhere else.
A new documentary shows how they became hip-hop's first empire.
Nobody changed the game the way the Wu-Tang Clan did.
Enter the Wu-Tang next time on Day to Day.
Today at noon on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Insight Business, high-speed internet, video, and fiber-based services. Insight Business, more information is available online at insightbusiness.com or at 1-800-639-TALK. WOSU-TV has great shows this holiday season, from special concert performances to insightful information and terrific travel shows. There's no better time to support your public television station. You'll like what you see on WOSU-TV. WOSU News reports on the stories you need to hear and the stories you want to hear.
We need to decide whether we as a country need manufacturing or whether we should just be a service-only industry.
Are you in favor of the bailout of the automobile industry?
Well, I'm absolutely in favor of an investment into domestic auto manufacturing.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU News team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and Classical Music.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. We're hearing about the results of a study of the impact of industrial farm animal production in America, impacts on unintended consequences on public health, the environment, animal welfare, rural communities. Now we're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, large numbers of animals of the same species confined in a facility, indoors or outdoors, where movement is restricted. We could be talking about poultry or about cattle, a number of hogs, a number of different possibilities here. The results from the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. It's a project of the Pew Charitable Trusts and of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And the report is entitled, and you can find it online, Putting Meat on the Table, Industrial Farm Animal Production in America. We have the executive director of the commission, Bob Martin, here in our studios, commission member Bill Nyman, who's also a rancher of the cattle, turkeys, goats, not in one of these concentrated operations. Also joining us from the Ohio Environmental Council, the director of environmental programs, Joe Logan, and the council is hosting the Pew Commission members here in Columbus. We're at 614-292-8513, and you can email comments or questions to openline at WOSU.org. And Deborah is on the line. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I'm calling to ask about the laws. It's wonderful that there is a commission that was able to research all of this. When I was in college a little over 20 years ago, we were discussing how the inhumane treatment of veal. And I was wondering, are there any, nothing's been resolved, it seems, it's the same old thing. Are there any laws on the books protecting animals the way our dogs and our pets are protected? Are there any laws on the books these big industries from the runoff that they're putting into our environment?
All right, Bob Martin.
And what are you going to do with your research? Is it the government that's going to use it, or is it us as citizens that can do something with it?
Well, I'll answer that last question first. The answer to that is yes. It's meant for citizens generally to use to educate themselves about the issues surrounding industrial farm animal production. It was in our grant to release to the nation, including members of the House and Senate. It's been sent or hand-delivered to every member of the House and Senate in Washington. It's been sent to every state governor, and it's been sent to every state attorney general because of the enforcement information in the report. As far as laws on animal welfare, there have been referendums around the country. Florida and Arizona have voted in the last 3 or 4 years to outlaw gestation crates for swine and battery cages for layer hens. Proposition 2 passed this last year in California or this last month in California, banning gestation crates and battery cages in California. And Bill told me something I didn't know is that it actually bans the importation of battery cage eggs from other states into California. So it's a very far-reaching law. The state of Colorado was very proactive. The governor there pulled together representatives of animal agriculture and people with humane treatment interests. One of our commissioners, Bernie Rollins of Colorado State University, kind of brokered the agreement, and legislation was passed in Colorado this last legislative session doing the same thing.
Joe Logan here in Ohio, no laws similar?
With regard to the humane treatment of animals, no, there are really none in Ohio. With regard to the environmental compliance, that is now administered under the Ohio Department of Agriculture that permits all these facilities. We just spoke by conference call with the assistant director and just met the director briefly earlier this morning. And we are entertaining a discussion about what we feel should be a more rigorous oversight of these operations, primarily in terms of their environmental compliance.
So in other words, you're saying you're not happy with the Ohio Department of Agriculture's regulations here in terms of effluent into waterways, into the air, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, if you survey the water quality in the state of Ohio, you can easily discern that there are still some glaring problems. And in our analysis of the laws and the rules that exist here in the state of Ohio, we think there are some glaring loopholes that really need to be closed and some increasingly stern oversight that needs to be.
Is Ohio particularly lax in these kind of environmental laws if you compare it with other states?
The directors of the program will tell you that they're very very stringent. But I think Bob had an opportunity to kind of review the 50 states and review them with respect to one another. Essentially, there are a few that are in a pretty strong class. The vast majority are kind of in the, I guess, laxed area. And I think the state of Ohio would be in that category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did a 50-state study in conjunction with the National Conference of State Legislatures, one of the research arms that all state legislatures around the country use. And in that survey, Joe portrayed it exactly right. There are a couple states that do it well. There are five states that are administered by the EPA. And while there are a lot of good laws on the books, there's very lax enforcement, and it's primarily not enough resources being put in oversight and testing and that sort of thing. I would say that Ohio is unique in that its Department of Agriculture will oversee the environmental oversight of industrial operation. It tends to rest in the environment or environment and natural resources state agency. And,
was it a move in Ohio in recent years to move it from the EPA to the Department of Agriculture?
Absolutely. It was a proactive move undertaken by the legislature to move in that direction. That is actually being finalized this week, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Was that move made in order to go a little easier on these animal operations?
Well, the thought within the agricultural community was that the Department of Agriculture would be much more friendly and understanding mm-hmm. of the circumstances under which they operated.
Friendly and understanding. Huh?
Yeah. That's absolutely true. And I think nobody doubts that. The question is, can you still apply the same level of environmental oversight and scrutiny and compliance within that system?
So Bob Martin, executive director of the Pew Commission here on the Farm Animal Production. If you had to give Ohio a grade in terms of regulating these big concentrated feeding operations in terms of the environment, what grade would you give us?
Well, you know, we originally set out to give all the states a grade, and we thought that would be an easy way for people to understand how their state was doing. And we found that states across the boards were doing so poorly that a grade would be meaningless because mm-hmm. virtually every state would get a D or an F.
Okay.
So that was the original reason for the multi-state study, and it was shocking, really, that while there's lots of good laws on the books, we don't necessarily need a lot of new laws. The laws need to be enforced. I'd like to say, too, on the federal level.
You would have needed great inflation to give anybody a D or an F.
That's right.
Okay.
On the federal level, there's a concern in the closing days of the Bush administration that the EPA is going to grant waivers for notification on the release of ammonia and hydrogen sulfide when it's vented from swine and egg and broiler production facilities. They're also turning the keys over to the industry about water or discharge of waste. They say every CAFO should be permitted and have a nutrient management plan. But if the CAFO says, oh, don't worry, we're not going to discharge, then they're exempted from that. We found that every CAFO at some time will discharge.
Will discharge into the water or into
yes.
the air. And again, CAFO, concentrated animal feeding operation.
That's
a big
correct.
Feedlot indoors or outdoors.
Right.
Yeah, Deborah, thanks for your question. And Twyla is next. Hello, Twyla.
Hello. I live in York Township in Union County here in Ohio, and our area is currently permitted for up to 3.3 million chickens. And a large corporation is currently trying to get permitted to build a 6 million chicken egg laying facility in the same area. Therefore, we have the potential for up to 11 million chickens in a 3-mile area.
Wow.
And so I'm curious as to what your opinion is about a concentration of this magnitude and how this, what you think this will do to our community's health.
11 million chickens, the potential here in a three-mile area. All right.
Well, my initial reaction, we met with some people in Union County yesterday, and my reaction was that I'm appalled that that's going on, that that's being allowed to happen. I think it'll be a serious threat to the health of the people living in the area, and I think that the environmental damage, I mean, I think it's a disaster waiting to happen.
Hmm.
I think it's a very serious mistake to have 3 million laying hens in one area, let alone 11 or 12 million.
Yeah. Joe Logan.
As Bob mentioned, we did meet with a number of folks up there yesterday, and we happen to be familiar that the watershed upon which that area rests is already impaired. And not only are there 3 million chickens already there, but there are several thousand hogs as well in some confinement scenarios. So, frankly, we think that previous impairment of watersheds, previous accumulations of nutrients in soils, all those things need to be taken in consideration in siting. And so far,
now, not. Who allows this siting? Who has the siting authority here?
All permitted by the Department of Agriculture.
Department of Agriculture. So nothing local residents, if they perceived that this was a threat to their health, I mean, if that was the argument they believed, what would be recourse for them?
Yeah, well, one of the ironies of this process of moving the oversight from the EPA to the Department of Agriculture was that during the time that this legislation was being created, at the 11th hour, a little clause was added to the legislation that removed all local authority from any decision-making process having to do with siting a facility.
So local residents don't get a voice?
Local residents, local county commissioners, township trustees, even health commissioners are now voiceless in this process.
Hmm. And that was something that the Pew Commission had in our final report as well. We had a series of criteria for zoning considerations, not necessarily stringent criteria, but things that local officials should take into account, but also that local officials should control the zoning and siting of these facilities because they know the area better than someone removed.
So now then, if I understand this right, the sole discretion here in terms of siting is with the Ohio Department of Agriculture. Does this need to have a vote of the legislature, or is it simply rulemaking by the Department of Agriculture?
Well, it had to originally have the passage of the state legislature. In fact, this morning, a hearing is taking place in front of the House Agriculture Committee and also the Senate Agriculture Committee to finalize the readjustment to the legislative process to make sure that this movement to the Department of Agriculture is completed.
And so Twyla, if she were to want to move against this siting, would have what recourse?
Well, first of all, local activity really matters, and we think that even under times when it seems as though the local authorities don't listen, if you're able to get your local citizens together and express a profound dislike or distrust for this process, talk to your officials, not only your elected officials, county commissioners, your state representatives, your U.S. House of Representatives members, and don't be afraid to call the Department of Agriculture and say, listen, we're concerned about this impaired watershed and adding another 11 million birds to this scenario.
Twyla, do you have a follow-up question?
The only other thing I wanted to point out was that, yes, the Bokes Creek watershed is impaired, has been impaired, and it also flows eventually into the Scioto River. So there are a lot of folks downstream that if we have any kind of a catastrophe with a manure spill, their drinking water will be affected or may potentially be affected.
Hmm. Red, may I take something? Add
yeah,
something
Bill Nyman.
One of the things that really alarmed me was that the in these challenging economic times that the state folks are looking at this as an economic opportunity. And I'm afraid that the dollars to the government are elusive, and we've addressed the economic impact of CAFOs on community in our report. But I really think that they have to weigh what they perceive as an economic opportunity for an area against the environmental and lifestyle costs to the locals who are going to really pay the price for this.
We're talking with the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. It's a project. They have a report called Putting Meat on the Table, Industrial Farm Animal Production in America. And they're a project of the Pew Charitable Trust and Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Joining us, Commission Member Bill Nyman, also the Executive Director of the Commission, Bob Martin, in our studios. Joe Logan with us, Director of Environmental Programs for the Ohio Environmental Council. Twyla, thank you for your call. And our next caller here is Dick. Hello, Dick. You're on the air.
Hi, I am Dick Isler, and I'm with the Ohio Pork Producers Council. I want to make sure that people know that our industry, the pork producers of Ohio, want to get involved with this. So far, it's been very one-sided, and I think there's been a lot of information, but frankly, a lot of misinformation discussed here this morning. And for example, I'd just like to point out the discussion about the use of stalls for housing. And I'm going to talk about pigs because that's what I know most about. I grew up on a farm, as Joe Logan knows, and my family still raises pigs, but they've changed the way they're doing it because, quite frankly, it's time to get the pigs out of the mud. The weather like we had here in Ohio yesterday with freezing, the pigs are much better off inside than they are outside, and some people would like to have them raised. And the same thing is true in the summertime when it's very hot. But there's a lot of challenges if you let pigs get in big groups like people are suggesting. Science has proven that gestation stalls are the most safe for the workers, safe for the pigs. Their pigs don't fight. I wished your listeners could see how pigs used to be raised and how much better off they are today in environmentally controlled buildings. And we've heard just one side of that. If we were to go, I heard you say a while ago, putting meat on the table, I would say if we were to go the way that's been suggested in a lot of the discussion, we'd be taking meat off the table for a lot of people. Another area you talked about was antibiotics. And let me just say, in Ohio, we have mostly family farms, and that's true whether how we're raising pigs, whether we're feeding antibiotics. And quite frankly, both large and small farms do use some antibiotics. And there's really no science that says there's any resistance carryover. There is no science for that. And quite frankly, Denmark and some other countries in Scandinavia have outlawed subtherapeutic use of antibiotics. What happens is the animals do get sick, and when you have to treat sick animals, you have to treat them at much higher rates. There's more antibiotics used the year after antibiotics were banned for subtherapeutic use than there was the year before because so many more animals got sick. So it's not quite as simple as was led before. Talking about how animals are raised, if people want to see how animals are raised, they should go to a website, www.porktour.com, and there's several veterinarians, individuals that work on farms that talk about raising pigs. So those are a few of some of the issues that I think need to hear the other side of the story, because there is another side. And the last thing I'd like to leave you with is farmers today realize we have a moral and ethical responsibility for the way we raise pigs. We take this very seriously. In fact, the pork industry has just established ethical principles for U.S. pork producers, and we are asking every one of our members to sign this. It includes their obligation for food safety, animal well-being, environment, public health, and employee care, plus the communities they operate in. So we take this very serious, and farmers do care about their animals, their environment, and their neighbors.
Dick, hang on the line if you'd like for a minute and talk with our panel. Bill Nyman, you indicated you had something to say to Dick.
Well, first of all, Dick, I respectively disagree with almost everything you've said. And one thing that really troubles me, if you're doing such a great job, why is it that you won't allow the public to come in and let them judge with a common sense viewpoint about what's going on inside of these buildings?
How is the pub? We've done that in several cases. We have our members that take tours to farms. We actually invite local leaders to their farms. So you couldn't be further from knowing the situation here in Ohio. We don't operate that way.
When I talk to the local press here on this tour, and I've talked to some, actually four or five discussions with press people, I've asked them if they've actually had an opportunity to be inside of a battery cage facility or a swine confinement facility, and they said they weren't able to get permission to enter them.
Have them call me. I'd love to visit with them and show them that because, the only restriction that I think our operations would have would be for biosecurity reasons. Like I said, we here in Ohio, as Joe Logan knows, have taken legislators, we've taken community leaders out to farms. That's what we do anyway here in Ohio. We really do want to educate people about modern livestock production because unlike the picture that's been painted there this morning, we think once they see the truth, like it's on these videos on this website I mentioned, they will see that, pigs and animals are fairly well treated today.
Well, do you think if you ask a pig would he'd rather live outdoors or in a confinement facility, what their answer would be?
Yeah, I think they would rather, in winter weather like we have here in Ohio, rather be inside because they're protected from the environment. Their nutrition requirements are taken care of. You don't have fighting the big fowls.
Again, I can't. I have to disagree with everything you're saying. So,
well, I'm sure you do, but I've been in the pork business for 50 years myself, and my family still raised them. So, yeah,
I can make the same claim. I can make the same claim. Interestingly enough, I just choose to do it in a different manner.
And that is your business that you are promoting these types of operation. I think
some of them in Ohio, as a matter of fact, yeah,
should be aware of that. That you are, promoting just these smaller farms, and in Ohio. We've had to change the way we're raising livestock. Family farms are just bigger than what they were a few years ago, like other businesses. So,
Joe Logan, would you like to weigh in here?
Yes. Hi, Dick. Good morning. Dick and I have known one another for many, many years, and I think Dick does a good job of representing the industry point of view. And Dick's points are on target in some regards. I think the industry has been attentive to these issues, even in some cases before the results of the Pew Commission were distributed. But certainly now they've been attentive to those issues. And I think the industry as a whole has tried to address some of the more worrisome aspects of the way pork is produced. And I think Dick's comments are also right, that the industry is not uniform. There are many producers throughout the state of Ohio that are more attentive to some of these issues of environmental compliance, of humanity to the animals than others, and have really tried to be attentive to that. So we want to be respectful of that, but to understand that the industry still has a way to go in terms of the way they address animals and the way they at the end of the day, put meat on the table.
Bob Martin, you'd like to say something?
Yeah, I would just like to address the mention of the Danish study. In 1989, the Swedish government banned the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in food animals, followed in 1996 by the Danish government. The European Union generally has banned the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in food animals since 2006. And the industry generally only tells the front half of the story about the Danish experience. When the ban went into effect, in the first year, Dick's right, the incidence of therapeutic use went up. And what they learned was that if they cleaned the pens better, the stalls better, and gave the animals more room, the incidence of disease went down. And so the therapeutic use went down over a five-year period and not up. And the overall amount pre-ban and post-ban, it was never higher post-ban in the use of therapeutic versus non-therapeutic and therapeutic. The other thing is they found in the European Union that the rates of human antibiotic resistance infections went down after banning the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in swine. Korea recently announced – South Korea recently announced they're banning the non-therapeutic use of seven antibiotics important to human medicine. So that's really the full range of the Danish study. I'd also like to say to Dick that I think that pigs have been bred genetically to produce – gain weight faster and to produce a certain size of animal – at the expense of their ability to exist out in natural conditions. So if he turned all his pigs loose out on a cold day like yesterday, yeah, they'd probably have a lot of trouble. But if you re-energize the genetic the gene pool and return their ability to live and be raised outdoors, they'll be fine. It's happened all over. They're raised in Canada outdoors. I mean, so it is possible.
And they love to go outside. So
they're not raised in Canada much different than they are here. And I'd say the reason we've changed the type of pig we've raised is because consumers back in the 1970s said they wanted a leaner, heavier muscled pig. We produce that for them. We'll produce the any kind of a pig the American consumer wants. And I would also say this: the U.S. is the number one producer of pork for exports around the world, and it's because we do things right here in this country. We really do. People all over the world demand our product. I think consumers in America want to continue seeing our animals, our crops, our food, as much as possible, raised within our own borders. And that certainly hasn't been true with some of the European countries that have got all these strict regulations for animal care, and they're ruled out certain ways of raising animals, ruled out a tool, antibiotics, that we use very judiciously because they're very costly to use. We don't use them because they're fun to use or anything like that. We use them because they help the overall environment that the animals are raised in. So I think we want to make sure we don't make these decisions and end up importing our food from other countries. I think that is something I think listeners care about.
Well, we've been a net importer of food since 2005, so we're already there. As far as
certainly not true with meat.
As far as raising pigs the way they do in Canada, Maple Leaf Farms has announced they're going to phase out gestation crates. Smithfield, the largest pork company in the United States, is going to phase out gestation crates. And Cargill is 6 years into a 10-year program to phase out gestation crates. So they're not doing that out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing that because I think they believe that's where the consumer is going. So, Dick, I hope you'll be ready to change your production model, because I think the consumers will demand it within 5 to 10 years.
Let me assure you, we will do whatever the consumers want, but we'd rather have the consumer make that decision instead of a bunch of animal rights activists who have been leading that charge. There is no question that is their goal, is to, you know, do away with animal production as we see it today. They are the ones truly leading the charge. So let's let the consumer and not activist group make that decision for us.
Dick, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
Sure.
Take care.
And our next caller here is Chuck. Hi, Chuck. We have just a moment here, but go ahead, please.
I'll make it real quick. I've been on hold just about the whole program, unfortunately. I have been involved in both the rulemaking committee and the oversight committee for CAPOs since the inception of the program. And I can assure you that the consensus decisions that have been made between folks like me who are looking after public concerns and representing public interest and the industries have been taken very seriously. And the effort between Ohio EPA in the changing of the guard to agriculture has also been done very well. I've been on some of these tours. Now, I don't want to argue the nuanced issues, but I can tell you that Ohio is doing very well and very aggressively concerned with manure management as far as the Clean Water Act is concerned, and has been involved in looking at air quality. And people that break the law in Ohio don't get away with it. I think my main concern at this point is the overall economy, which is going to keep Ohio from being able to staff its CAPO unit up to where it can continue to aggressively supervise and monitor the situation. And I'll listen. Thank you.
Chuck, thanks so much for your call. And gosh, that brings us completely out of time here. We've been talking with the members of the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. It's a project of the Pew Charitable Trust and Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. You can find the report online entitled Putting Meat on the Table, Industrial Farm Animal Production in America. Commission member Bill Nyman, Executive Director Bob Martin, thank you for being with us. Joe Logan, Director of Environmental Programs for the Ohio Environmental Council, hosting the Pew Commission here. Thank you for being with us this hour as well. And news is next at WOSU 820 NPR News Columbus.
Support for WOSU comes from CATCO, celebrating its 25th anniversary season with the Santaland Diaries by David Sedaris and adapted by Joe Mantello, on stage through December 28th at Studio 3 in the Rife Center, online at catco.org.